call the House Committee on Judiciary to order. Today is February 4th. First item on the agenda is a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 4081. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4081 and call Attorney General Rosenblum, please.
That's how my park stomachs. You are so.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Rosenblum. I'm the Attorney General for the State of Oregon, and I come before you today in support of House Bill 4081. With me is Elizabeth Grant, head of the Department of Justice Charitable Activities Section. I would like to open by thanking Representative Vicki Berger for her leadership in bringing attention to this issue and helping us develop the legislative concept you have before you. I would also like to thank Jim White, Executive Director of the Nonprofit Association of Oregon, for his support and constructive suggestions throughout the drafting process. I believe we've incorporated nearly all of those suggestions into the amended version of the bill. I've said it before, but I feel strongly that it bears repeating, the vast majority of charities in Oregon are doing an amazing job, delivering the maximum possible return for every dollar donated. But for various reasons, there are a small minority of charitable organizations that struggle to maintain the sort of financial and organizational transparency that Oregonians deserve in return for their charity. House Bill 4081 seeks an appropriate balance between providing assurance that charitable organizations are being truthful, accurate, and transparent in their interactions with state regulators while not overburdening the vast majority of already compliant charities with unnecessary paperwork, busy work, or red tape. More than 18,000 charitable organizations are currently registered with the Charitable Activities Section of the Department of Justice in Oregon. Since 1996, the number of registered charities has almost doubled. As you can imagine, as the number of charities increases, so have the number of cases where the information provided in the required reports is incomplete, misleading, or simply incorrect. For example, our annual report form contains a question which inquires of a charity if they have ever been the subject of a disciplinary action in any other state in the past. A recent audit by KATU found that at least 30 charities which had indicated within their report with our office that they had never been the subject of a disciplinary action in another state, when this was in fact not true. The scope of these out-of-state violations varies, ranging from small administrative fees for a missed filing up to judgments in the hundreds of thousands of dollars for allegations of misleading donors or suspending the organization's registration in the state in some instances. The Department of Justice relies on these reports to look for everything from accidental but important mistakes in reporting all the way up to deliberate patterns of misrepresentation or mismanagement. House Bill 4081 clarifies several aspects of the reporting requirement and provides the DOJ Charities Division with additional tools to investigate possible noncompliance. New language in Section 7 of the bill clearly specifies violations of Oregon's Charitable Trust and Corporation Act and makes clear that the Attorney General has the ability to request documents to substantiate representations made in a registration document or another report. It allows the Attorney General to request information to establish that a charitable organization has properly applied charitable funds received by donors. It also explicitly prohibits the filing of a false or misleading statement. Section 7 also provides us with a series of enforcement mechanisms to address these compliance issues. As the head of my charitable activity section, Ms. Grant can tell you many of our enforcement actions are as simple as sending a letter or correcting a misunderstanding. We do not resort to more formal actions unless more cooperative attempts at obtaining the necessary information or bringing a charitable organization into compliance with the law have failed. But when we feel that a bigger stick is needed, Section 7 ensures that the charitable organization also receives a fair process. Again, it bears repeating, most charities follow the law, and some of those that break the rules do so because of a simple misunderstanding or mistake. And we can work with those organizations. But it is important that we have the ability to obtain the accurate information that we need, and that is required. So that concludes my testimony. Ms. Grant and I are available. She is available in particular to answer any technical questions that you may have about the bill.
Thank you. Joe, any questions? Representative Olson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I guess I would point out that I'm sorry that you've been demoted to the Senate Judiciary Committee member. I mean, Chair. So just thought I'd point that out. Sorry. This is a joke.
Did I do something wrong?
Thank you. My first question actually goes to Section 7 of the bill, and it's subsection C. Could you define to me what a timely manner is?
If I may defer to Ms. Grant to answer the specific questions. Thank you, Representative Olson, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
I'm afraid I don't have now I'm looking at the exact language. Chair Barker, Representative Olson, in a timely manner would be when we're talking about reports, for example.
You need to identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. Yes. My name is Elizabeth Grant. I'm the attorney in charge of the charitable activities section at the Department of Justice. And to return to the question about what does a timely mean, with respect to annual reports, our department follows the same guidelines as the Internal Revenue Service. And so the Internal Revenue Service provides that the report is due 4.5 months after the close of the organization's fiscal year, although they could get an extension, and we also allow extensions for up to 6.5 months, for up to 6 months on top of the 4.5 months. So an organization that requests the full time period would have 10.5 months from the conclusion of their fiscal year to file the report about that information.
So just follow up with that, Mr. Chair. So, Elizabeth, somehow in the communication then with the charity, you would notify them or they'd be aware of that timeline?
Yes. Chair Parker, Representative Olson, when a charity registers with our office, they receive some explanatory information explaining the reporting deadlines and when their reports will be due. Our office also mails out the reports to the organizations in advance of their, several months in advance of their due date. So that gives another opportunity for them to realize that they have these reporting obligations.
Okay, and I just have one other question, Mr. Chair. And Elizabeth, this will probably be directed for you too as well. Then with the small charities, because a lot of them, and there's a lot of them, I mean, they do not have the resources available to them that the larger ones do. How are you going to deal with them a little differently for their ability to respond?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, even small charities now have minimal reporting obligations. We think that they're easy to comply with, and those reporting obligations would not change. In particular, it provides an important educational opportunity with those small charities because that's when they register, that's when we explain to them some of the obligations they have with respect to reporting. Typically, we always try to do some sort of voluntary method, the most expedient method of getting the reports in or resolving whatever the compliance issue may be. So we will, you know, work cooperatively to the extent possible. But every once in a while, even for small charities, we need to have a tool that gets their attention that will help the report process rise to the stack of priorities that we know that many organizations have.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have charities and you have nonprofits, and you could have a charity, of course, has a component of a nonprofit, but you could have a nonprofit that does not have a charity component. Are they both covered?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, our law covers charitable organizations and charitable assets. So there are other types of nonprofits, such as mutual benefits, that are not subject to registration and not subject to the same sort of enforcement authority that we have over charitable assets. So the law that we're talking about today really covers charitable organizations and charitable assets.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So either one of you may answer this. Thanks so much for coming today. I did not see KATU's program about this issue. Can you tell us what prompted this and what kinds of behaviors or situations were serious enough that you came forward with a bill like this?
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, members of the committee, it is my understanding that KATU did a program that came to the attention both of my charity section and also to Representative Berger, as well as to the association that Mr. White is involved with. And there was a kind of a collaboration, if you will, to prepare this draft based on concerns that were raised through that program. I will turn to Ms. Grant if she has any more specific information about that.
Thank you.
Representative Berger, come up.
Chair Barker. KATU did a story, and they based some of their data on that Tampa Bay paper has been doing a lot of investigative charitable reporting. And that paper compiled a list of enforcement actions across the country, and the KATU reporter sort of diligently compared the answers in that database with what we had received and found these discrepancies. And I think that, and I sort of highlighted the fact that our law is, as it stands now, is not all that clear on what the remedies would be for providing false or misleading information.
Representative Berger?
Yes, for the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20. Thank you for the question, Representative Tomei, and I can have my staff get you a link to the original report by KDU. I saw it at my home and was struck by the fact that we had a brief upcoming session, and one of the purposes of this kind of session is to correct holes that we see that are obvious and easy to fix. And this is one. It was pretty clear from the report that we say that you will report this, and if you report it inaccurately, we had no remedy for the AG. Oh, gee, you filed this report. You said there were no actions against your charity. Well, hello, we found out there are. What are you going to do about it is sort of the answer. Well, this says we can do something about it, and it isn't. We are going after sharks, not minnows. I, as all of you, have served on nonprofit boards. I know how hard it is to raise money in a nonprofit venue, and I would do nothing to hurt those charities that raise money and spend it on the things we all care about. But we also need to protect the minnows from the sharks who might not be playing on the same playing field. And in the revenue department or in the revenue committee, we've had bills where charities who ought to know better just forgot to file when they bought a huge bunch of property for a property tax exemption, and then the bill comes due and they're going to DOR saying, but we're a charity. Well, you know, somebody should have filed that when you bought the property. So charities make mistakes. I'm very aware of them. The bill is solid. There is a Dash 1 amendment that was suggested by the nonprofit organizations and that I would ask you to approve that even makes it more clear. It says willfully. It uses that term that says we're not going after people who make an honest mistake. We're going after people who really intend to deceive in some way. And that, so I would suggest to you that the Dash 1 amendment is excellent and the one that I am promoting because it makes it crystal clear, and this was at the suggestion of the nonprofit organizations who you will hear from soon and who have been at the table because they know that having their donors be confident when they give their money means a lot to all of us.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions, Representative Hicks?
I think, and this is something I don't know, so I'm looking for technical kind of answers, but I think the largest nonprofit in my community would be a hospital. And so is this the kind of legislation that would implicate hospitals as a nonprofit kind of entity?
I'm going to ask Representative Hicks, members of the committee, and Chair Barker, I'm going to ask Ms. Grant to respond to that. She has a lot of involvement with the hospitals as charitable organizations, and I think she can respond well to that question.
Great. Yes, Representative Hicks. It would apply broadly to all charitable organizations, which could include nonprofit hospitals. I think in general, we see nonprofit hospitals have compliant staff and are generally very compliant, but it could potentially apply to them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, before this bill, before I read this bill this morning, it never occurred to me that there was not a clear remedy at law for somebody misstating a required report to the Attorney General. I think this is exactly the kind of technical fix that I think the February session is made for. I appreciate the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, panel.
Thank you very much, thank Mr. You. Chair.
And James White. Please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is James White. I'm the Executive Director of the Nonprofit Association of Oregon, and we are in support of HB 4081-1. As you just heard in testimony, I feel like they actually just did all my work for me. I did think it was important to come here today, though, to express the voice of the nonprofit community. We are a nonprofit association. We represent the sector of nonprofits, of charitable nonprofits, throughout the state. And I think this bill is a good example of legislative, executive branch, and nonprofits coming together to, as Representative Barton just stated, fixing a small loophole in existing law that allows for proper remedies to be put in place. We very much appreciated the opportunity to work with Representative Berger and the Attorney General's office on this by suggesting some changes to the first enrolled version of the bill, particular to this language around willful, and making sure that it was, as Representative Berger testified, the minnows did not get caught in the net. What we used as criteria, and we checked this with some of, we didn't have time to go out and take a broad sampling or survey of how organizations might feel about this, but what we did do is some focus groups with some nonprofits, and we used this kind of thinking in our criteria on how we would look at this bill and the suggestions that we put forward. And that included minimize additional financial or reporting requirements, given that the vast majority of nonprofits regularly and faithfully comply with the law. Give organizations that do run afoul of regulation the opportunity to correct their infringement with appropriate penalties so that they can get back on track. And finally, to help the Attorney General's office to truly go after those nonprofits that willfully disregard the law and erode the public's trust in the entire nonprofit sector. We think it's abhorrent when we see these organizations that give a black eye to our sector, that are not complying with the law, and we feel that there's a proper remedy that should be within the purview of the state in this case to be able to take action. So, with that in mind, we support this bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What would be a common example of a nonprofit that would be violative of the charitable activities statutes? What's the worst? What's the most common way they do this willfully?
Chair Barker, Representative Hicks, I may not be the best person to answer that. I think maybe Ms. Grant might be able, because she's the one regularly handling these, but I could take some. I think it's going to be that there are cases where organizations simply fill out the paperwork incorrectly. That's not willful, and that's what we understand. This law will let through those who just make a mistake. They can correct their mistake and go forward and do their good work. I think that what I've understood by watching the K2 report, by reading some of the press that was done out of Florida, is that there are organizations that are raising funds here in Oregon who have run afoul of charitable laws in other states. And when they're filling in their paperwork here, they are not disclosing that they've run afoul of laws. So that's the examples.
I should have asked Ms. Grant. It didn't occur to me when she was up here, but I mean, and by no means would it, if you don't know the answer, don't worry about it. But like, let's say a nonprofit or a charitable organization was expending 70-80% of its income on its own overhead and administrative expenses. Would that be an example, maybe of them running afoul of the charitable activities code, either revenue wise or otherwise?
Chair Barker represents.
Thanks. Okay.
In fact, there was a law passed last year, which this good legislature passed, which we indeed supported as well, called HB 2060, yeah. That actually deals with those kinds of issues of organizations that are not meeting a certain floor of expenditure to their program mission. And it is indeed 30%. If over a three-year period an organization does not spend a minimum of 30% of their funds that they collect, in that their programmatic funds, if they're not spending that on their mission, then the Attorney General's office has now remedies to start talking to them about what might happen. But this law closes, I think, a different loophole. It deals with giving the Attorney General's office appropriate remedies for these misfilings, misrepresentations, true misrepresentations. And again, we appreciate the opportunity to be clear in the Dash 1 amendment that these are willful in nature. Thank you.
Chair Barker, Representative Hicks, this is Elizabeth Grant with the Department of Justice again. And if I might address that question, there was some legislation that was passed last year that's based upon the forms that organizations file in terms of the effect of falling below certain thresholds. And I think that's why this legislation is important, because we need to have some mechanism to ensure that people don't misrepresent on the forms to avoid the implications of that law. I think one of the most common enforcement problems we have are organizations that simply stop reporting, and at some point that does become willful after a number of reminders, and that's where we're hoping that we can get a more expedited resolution to that common compliance issue.
Could I do one more follow-up,
please? Please.
Thank you. What would happen then if there isn't an entity that is not expending at least 30% of its income on objectively, you know, charitable causes? What happens to that entity? And does this bill implicate the consequence in any way?
This bill does, Chair Barker, Representative Hicks. This bill does not directly address that situation. And the legislation that does relate to the program expenditures, we're still in the process of making rules to implement that. But ultimately, it would disqualify organizations that don't spend enough on charitable programs, according to their own forms that they file, from receiving tax-deductible donations for Oregon income tax purposes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have the Dash 1 amendments before us.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 4093.
Representative Barton moves the 4081.
Excuse me, 4081. My mistake.
Yeah. Representative Barton moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 4081. Is there any objections? Discussion, hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4081 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 4081 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Cameron?
Excused.
Representative Hicks?
Aye.
Representative Leininger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Williamson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Thank you. Who would like to carry the bill? Right. Representative Berger, would you carry the bill for us, please?
Thank you.
Okay, open up public hearing on House Bill 4086. Council, please.
Representative Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 4086 will make personally identifiable information collected on passengers through a mass transit system no longer subject to public disclosure.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carolyn Tomei, and I'm a state representative from House District 41. House Bill 4086 is a bill that will protect the privacy of public transit riders by exempting individual transit customer travel patterns from the public records law. Over the next few years, TriMet will be implementing a new electronic fare collection system, such as a tap card system, similar to other large transit agencies. In connection with this new system, TriMet will collect personally identifiable information from riders. This includes information about individual riders' travel patterns and riders' private financial and account information. As a public body, TriMet is subject to the Oregon Public Records Law, and they are concerned that this personally identifiable information may be subject to disclosure. While financial records are clearly protected under ORS 192.501, personal travel pattern information is not currently specifically exempted from disclosure. I agreed to sponsor this bill because I share TriMet's concern about disclosing this type of personal information. It doesn't take a very active imagination to conceive of circumstances where public access to this information could be dangerous. For example, a victim of domestic violence who lives in a shelter with her children could have her daily bus travel patterns requested by her abuser. This is just one example. There are many other conceivable cases where publicly available personal travel records pose a privacy and a safety risk, and this is not acceptable. This bill will clearly exempt individual transit customer travel patterns from the public records law while still allowing for the public to request non-personal aggregate data. I will now turn it over to Tim Snyder from Stoll Reeves and Chris Tucker from TriMet, who can answer the technical questions that I will be unable to answer.
Thank you, Representative.
I'm turning it over to them, and I'm going to go sit up there.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Representative Tomei, thank you for listening to us today. My name is Tim Snyder. I'm a partner at Stoll Reeves, a law firm in Portland, Oregon. And part of my practice involves advising businesses and individuals on the public records law. I've submitted written testimony in advance of today that has been made available to the committee. So I'm going to try to keep my comments brief and allow the chair and members of the committee to ask questions that they may have about the bill. The public records law serves an important function in Oregon by creating government transparency. To that end, the law is extremely broad, such that public bodies, virtually anything a public body collects in terms of documents or information, is subject to the public records law absent a specific exemption that exempts it from disclosure to the public. As government services evolve, and you've heard how TriMet is evolving and how it's handling how it's going to be handling fares in the future, as government services evolve and IT advancements are made, governments and public bodies are finding themselves collecting consumer information, confidential, personally identifiable information, information about travel patterns. And when this happens, and it's happened repeatedly, if you look at ORS Chapter 192, Sections 501 and 502, from time to time, the legislature is called upon to enact a new exemption to take care of a new type of information that's coming into the hands of public bodies. And so here, we have an e-fare system, and I'm going to let Mr. Tucker, who is the Director of Revenue Operations at TriMet, speak to some of the specific technical aspects of the e-fare system and questions that you might have. But that system is going to collect personally identifiable information on TriMet riders, including traditional customer account information, names, addresses, dates of birth, personally identifiable information. It's going to collect payment information, credit cards, debit card information, and as Representative Tomei was testifying about, it's going to collect travel information,
travel pattern information. And that's very important to how the system operates, as Mr. Tucker is going to tell you. But it also means that a public body has this mass of information. So what's the solution? The solution is House Bill 4086. And what that bill does is it creates the maximum amount of protection for this type of information under the Oregon Public Records Law. And in so doing, it ensures that TriMet riders and riders of other mass transit systems in Oregon that adopt similar e-fare systems, that the information collected by those public bodies is not subject to public records requests by a domestic abuser, by a business that wants to do, for example, direct marketing at TriMet riders, by you know, identity thieves or others who could take that information and use it adversely to riders. We have examples of this, these types of statutes passing in our very own public records law. For example, in my written testimony, I pointed out that public utilities have a similar personally identifiable information exemption from the public records law, since they also, in the course of providing water and power, collect this type of information on Oregon citizens, and prior legislature deemed it appropriate to exclude that type of information from public records requests. We've pointed to Georgia, Utah, and Florida, and other states that have also seen this as an issue under their public records law and have enacted blanket exemptions to preserve the confidentiality of that information from public records. So for those reasons, I support passing House Bill 4086. Thank you.
Mr. Tucker? Or hi. Any questions, panel?
I actually have a question. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. The utility exemption, is it under 501 or 502?
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, it's under 502.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Chris Tucker, Director of Revenue Operations at TriMet. I'd like to thank Representative Tomei for bringing this bill forward for us. I'm here as the project leader for this electronic fare collection system, which we call eFare for short, that we're developing for mass transit in the greater Portland metropolitan region. Our eFare project is similar to many others around the country, as has been mentioned, Salt Lake City, Atlanta, San Francisco, Seattle, and the list goes on around the United States and the world. In summary, we're building this payment system to better serve our riders. It will allow our riders to pay as they board a bus or a train. They will be able to use a transit debit card to board the vehicles. They'll be able to use open payments such as contactless debit and credit cards or even smartphones. All the customers have to do is simply tap a validator to board the vehicle. For our agency, it reduces operational costs, such as cost of collecting fares. It reduces costly and complex electromechanical ticket machines. And it also reduces revenue leakage by electronically managing transfers. So from an agency side, there are many benefits. Those are just a few. From the customer side, there are a myriad of benefits, such as balance protection if someone loses their fare. Right now, if they lose a paper ticket, they're out the money. In the future, they'll have an electronic card that they can close down if they need to. They can load value anytime, anywhere, and it's a streamlined process for them to tap a vehicle and board, where currently now they flash a piece of paper and the operator tries to read it quickly. To support this new way to pay, the system creates an account, and that's similar to a bank account. And the system tracks the usage to allow riders to verify their charges on that account. So with all of the benefits of this account-based system, it's essential that we maintain these strong privacy protections. TriMet does have significant concerns about being required to disclose travel patterns, especially in cases, as Representative Tomei has mentioned, domestic violence issues. Other states have implemented this, as has been mentioned, and we are seeking this complete exemption, which does remove TriMet from the burden of deciding whether these requests are lawful. And unless Mr. Snyder has anything else, that concludes our testimony.
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions, which I got to my friend Mr. Snyder in advance. Further evidence that I'm getting soft in my old age. But I think it's a question that perhaps Representative William has is, Williamson has as well, which is, should this be in 501 or 502? The bill as written puts it in 502. And just by way of background, there are essentially three ways that we can remove documents from public record exemption. The most extreme way that's very rarely done, I've seen it attempted once and it didn't go over well, would be remove it from the definition of public record altogether. It's in 192.005. Much more commonly, we put it in either 192, either 502 or 501. And 501 is kind of the lower tier. It means that they are exempt from public records unless it is found to be in the public interest disclosure. It's kind of subject to that balancing. 502 is just presumed exempt from disclosure. There's no balancing there. This is in 502. Why 502? Why not 501? It would make me, anyway, a lot more comfortable.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, it's a very good question. It's a very fair question. I have a couple responses. First of all, we've got precedent, which is that with respect to personally identifiable information in other contexts, utility context, PERS context, public employee information context, the legislature's chosen to balance that for the agency, to look at the private interest and the public interest and make a decision that the private interest outweighs the public interest and has enacted a complete exemption and placed it in 502. And that's what House Bill 4086 asks this committee and the legislature to do, is to do the balancing for government and place it there, similar to what was done with the utilities. Second, we have other states that we can look at and see what they've done. They've similarly balanced the interests and said, this type of travel history information, this type of customer account information is the kind of thing we want to completely exempt from our public records law. And finally, it does relieve an administrative burden that's placed on agencies when these types of exemptions are put in Section 501, because then what happens is TriMet, for example, gets a public records request. They have to go, okay, who's asking for this? Why are they asking for this? What's the reason? They have to investigate. They have to make a determination. That determination can be second-guessed. They can get tied up in litigation before the Attorney General in the first instance, before the courts if it keeps up through the appeal process created by the public records law. And so House Bill 4086 requests that, similar to utilities, that decision be made here, that decision be made by the legislature, and taken away from agencies having to do this on a case-by-case basis.
So, and this is an honest question, I really don't know. Let's pretend we were to put it in 502, the bill as drafted. What is the remedy to that? Do they have standing to challenge that in court? Let's pretend there is public interest, or is it in a black box forever? Did that make sense?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, is the information a black box? I would say no, because the public records law only deals with one aspect of how information gets out into society, which is, can a member of the public demand an agency to produce that information under the public records law? If there was, for example, a subpoena in a civil proceeding or a grand jury subpoena, or TriMet made the decision for reasons it had as an agency in the exercise of its discretion to release certain types of information, it could certainly do that. So this information is not in a black box. It's simply not subject to anybody off the street demanding that the information be turned over to them.
I do one more.
Yes.
Sorry to take up so much time. The other question I have, changing somewhat, is it seems like a lot of the information that this bill is designed to protect there are already a lot of sections, both in 501 and 502, on point. One that comes to mind would be in 501, subsection 27, the financial transactions one. Do these count as financial transaction? I think it might be ambiguous, but quite possibly. Like, is this somewhat redundant?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, it's another good question, and I would say this, that some of the information that's being collected in the eFair system probably does fit within other aspects of the public records law. For example, the fund transfer provision that you mentioned, that it's debatable what that covers. Presumably that might cover the credit card account information, the information necessary to do a fund transfer. What it doesn't appear to cover is maybe the general account information. Who's writing TriMet? Where do those TriMet writers live? It also doesn't appear to cover travel history. Where is this rider going? What are they doing on the system? So it covers part, but not all. And again, similar to what the utilities provision that's already in the public records law, that exemption, certain of that information was probably also covered by the fund transfer provision, and the decision was made, let's make it clear this applies to this type of information by this public body and this kind of service. So that's the response. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I have one. So the information, other information, okay, so would TriMet disclose all this information but without the name? So I can see people travel on the MAX from Willow Creek to the convention center every day, but I don't have a name to it. Will the public be able to access those the records just with essentially with the names redacted?
Chair Barker, good question. I think that's contemplated in the definition of personally identifiable information, and it talks about all information relating to a person, and that language is intended to get at information at the person level.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, the system will be designed to anonymize the data so that we're able to report on ridership information at an aggregate level. So we would be able to say, you know, 15 adults boarded at this time at this location. That information and that data is powerful and useful for TriMet for service planning purposes, but it anonymizes it and doesn't link it back to a particular person, name, address type of a concept. And so that the data is still there. It's a data-driven system, but it pulls the name and anonymizes them from that reporting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In any of the states that have exempted this kind of information or this travel information, like TriMet will be collecting, have any of them used a 501 type balancing test around public interest? And if they have, in what kinds of situations? Since we don't know what this is going to look like for TriMet, I'm interested in how it's playing out in other communities.
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, thank you for the question. I've not done an exhaustive search of every statute in the United States that may cover this, but we've identified a couple, and I cited them in my written testimony. Georgia is a blanket exemption. Utah is a blanket exemption. And both of those also refer directly to travel dates, times, frequency of use. They capture that, and they specifically exclude it, along with the customer account information. Florida excludes all information about transit fare processing. Washington has a provision as well. That provision, and I cited it, and you can read it a little more closely if you're curious how Washington did it, but it does have some minor exceptions for example, if somebody was thinking there was fraud in connection with who was actually purchasing the fare, the Washington statute permitted somebody upon a showing that they needed it to show that somebody was fraudulently taking fares, they could request it under those circumstances and a few other unique circumstances. But I've not seen a statute that requires an agency to balance public interest versus private interest on a case-by-case basis for this type of information.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Have you got a sense of what transaction costs would attach to a work through that required that enabled that put it in, I guess, O2, or the provision it's not in now, so that the agency had a burden to demonstrate that it was in the public interest to shield that information? Do you have an estimate of cost?
Chair Barker, Representative Leininger, I don't have an estimate of cost. I know from my own practice, when issues come up on a public records law and whether something's subject to disclosure or not, requires analysis, a statute requires fact investigation. And it requires some time and energy to put together a reasoned opinion as to whether something should be disclosed or shouldn't be disclosed. And in this case, it would require a balancing of what's the private interest of the writer versus the public interest of whatever purpose the presenter or the requester has asked for the information for. And the problem is that those analyses can be done with the best of intentions. A reasoned opinion comes out as suggesting no, and then that can get tied up in courts, and then it can get very expensive and time-consuming. I don't have specific studies, though.
Good question. Thank you very much. Becky Strauss, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. We are neutral on the bill, and I have submitted written testimony, and there's a packed room, so I will try to be brief. I'm here just to report back on some, well, first of all, I should say we have no problem with the exemption in public record for these travel patterns, but I think you've heard a lot of testimony today from TriMet recognizing the very sensitive nature of the information about riders that's being collected in the electronic fare program. I recognize this all will be collected. The program has not rolled out yet. So I've begun some conversations, and I'm here to ask you to start to continue those conversations with TriMet about all the other privacy issues that are involved in electronic fare collection program. Starting to really think about and urging you all to think about any type of data collection in the view of really a privacy roadmap, asking some really basic questions about the data collection, and I've set those out in my written testimony, and you'll hear a lot about that roadmap from me, certainly in this month and in the years to come. But the usage of the information, should we be collecting it all? Who is collecting it? What type of information are we collecting? And here, obviously, we're talking about TriMet collecting not only financial account information, but travel pattern information, which can be very sensitive about where am I going to worship when I take TriMet to do that, or political associations or doctor's appointments, all sorts of things that carry very important privacy implications. And so, as I said, I've started to have some of those conversations with TriMet, and ask you to do so as well as the rest of the electronic fare collection program is rolled out and developed. I know that from conversations I've had, TriMet is working on a privacy policy that will include notice to consumers or riders about what information will be collected about them when they use this electronic fare collection program. We'll also be looking at how long, and this issue has been raised already in some of the testimony and from Chair Barker, how long will the information stay identified as opposed to de-identified or in some sort of anonymized fashion? Certainly don't have any problem with de-identified information that helps TriMet better their service. The issue is how long is it kept in a way that's identifiable to one individual? And of course, with that, this bill is meant to look at when the public by request has access to that information, but when do all other entities have access to that information? What types of sidebars can we put in place to guard against perhaps selling personally identifiable information? Sharing with law enforcement without a warrant would be something that we would certainly advocate against or advocate for those sidebars. And several other questions. So, as I mentioned, we're here today neutral on this bill, but just asking you to stay involved as the program develops and be asking these questions of TriMet as well.
Thanks. Any questions from us? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Kelsey Wilson, Dan Jarman, Therese Bottomley.
Dan asked me to let you know he had to step out, so he may be coming back, but he had to step out for a meeting. Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Kelsey Wilson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association, and with me I have Therese Bottomley, who is our membership's public records expert. So we have some concerns with this bill. As you can imagine, newspapers would like to see no public records exemptions and like to see everything open, but understand there are circumstances in which that's not feasible or there's interest that would like them closed. And we can understand that. We can certainly sympathize with the domestic violence situation where we wouldn't want a victim to be tracked by their stalker or abuser either. With that said, we would like to propose moving this exemption to the 501 section of the statute. We feel strongly that the blanket exemption is too strong and would like to, if the person requesting the public records can prove that it's in the public interest, that information should be available. This is not information that is out there yet. We don't know how exactly it's going to function when the program gets started. And so with a blanket exemption, we are afraid that there may be circumstances where the public interest should have this information. And the burden of proof is on the requester of the information, and would like to move that into 501. We also have some concerns with the language in the bill as it's currently drafted, that and I know in talking with TriMet that their intent is to have the aggregate and anonymized data available, but our concerns is that the language isn't clear and that information right now is not available. It says in their other identifiable information, and we would be concerned that the anonymized data that that says Rider 151, that would be an identifiable information that may not allow us to have access to that rider with or without their name. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Therese and let her add her comments.
Thanks. Therese Bottomley, the Oregonian. Thanks for having us today. I'd just like to point out the way the law typically works for the Oregonian. I handle a lot of public records requests for reporters, and I would just point out the K2 story that came up earlier couldn't have been done without the benefit of the Oregon public records law, so that was a good example of it in use for the good of the public. So typically we request records. The agency that holds those records then cites the exemption that they think is applicable, or they release the records. And once they've cited that exemption, if we feel strongly about getting those records, we would appeal that decision to either the Attorney General's office or the district attorney in whatever county the agency is in. And then that's the place where we would argue the public interest, and we would have to be able to articulate a reason that in this particular instance the public interest is in disclosure. And so that independent office then makes a determination one way or the other whether to order the records released. If the agency then further believes they should not be released, they have the option of going to circuit court at that point to oppose release.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I'm looking, and this is for either of you, as I'm looking at the difference between the information listed in 501 and 502, in 501, it's information like trade secrets, test questions, business records, and in 502, it's specifically information of a personal nature. So help me understand why personal travel information belongs in a balancing test of a list of arguably very less personal information than your comings and goings. And so I'm trying to decide which list it belongs in, and it seems like what's in 501 is just not similar data.
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, I think you see precedent in both. I'm looking at 501 here and some exemptions, for instance, exempt the home address, professional address, telephone number of a person who has donated money to the University of Oregon University System. It exempts records of the name and the address of a person who files a report to a commodity commission. It exempts Social Security numbers of parties to certain judicial proceedings. It exempts student electronic mail addresses. So there's many personally identifiable pieces of information in 501 already. And as to the utility example that was brought up earlier, if memory serves, a newspaper, not the Oregonian, wrote an article called Water Hogs.
where they called out some of the people, individuals, who were using the most water in the city of Portland. And that may or may not have been part of the reason that that exemption got put into the law. But I would argue it should be in 501, not 502, because I think in some ways there's probably an interest in who is wasting water and causing other people's rates to go up. So in terms of precedent, I think there's precedent in both 501 and 502 for personally identifiable information.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bottomley, first of all, let me note that I'm forced to agree with you that I wish I could say otherwise. I can't see any cogent policy difference between what we put in 501 and 502. It seems like a hodgepodge of ad hoc decisions to me. But my question for you is, how often does this actually happen? How often do you appeal an agency under 501? How often do you appeal something to the Attorney General or the District Attorney, and then it ends up going in circuit court? Is this something that your paper would do once a year, once every 10 years? I have no idea. Maybe it's every month. I have no idea.
Well, I would say thank you to this body for being really great on public records. So the Oregonian and every member of the media uses the public records law routinely, week in and week out. It may be, I want a copy of your budget. I want a copy of the contract that the superintendent of schools has. So those kind of just very basic sharing of information happen all the time. The disputes can run in, you know, I can get three in a month, I can get none for 3 months. But going to court, I've been at the Oregonian for 30 years. We've had one, maybe two public records lawsuits that have actually gone to that level and then went to mediation.
Okay. Thank you very much. Members, here's an amendment being drawn up for this bill, so we won't move the bill today. We'll wait to take a look at the amendment that's coming.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 486 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4093. All good representatives, please. You can bring up anybody else you like. Alex, you want to, excuse me. Council, please, if you would introduce the bill for us.
Representative Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 4093 will make reports voluntarily submitted to the State Department of Fish and Wildlife and written agreements relating to the conservation of wild birds voluntarily entered into with the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, subject to a public disclosure exemption.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for hearing this bill today. Representative Cliff Bentz, District 60, which is, of course, Harney County, Malheur County, Grant County, Baker County, and part of Lake County, just a fraction less than a third of all of Oregon. The sage grouse has been declared a candidate species under the Endangered Species Act, and as a result, much of the activity that currently occurs on both public and private land could be dramatically restricted. And we're all familiar with this process because of the spotted owl exercise, the salmon in the Columbia exercise, the bull trout endangered species listing, the situation in the Klamath, and several others across the state of Oregon. The result of a listing is to impose upon landowners requirements to comply with no-take provisions of the Endangered Species Act. And of course, this means that those who have been placing maybe a certain number of cattle on their own private land could be restricted from putting that same number of cattle out on their own private land. Those that might want to put a fence across that land or dig a ditch across that land or put a pipeline in across the land or do any other thing, should there be a listing that would affect critical habitat, could be precluded from doing so. Most of my constituents don't yet understand the reach and scope of the Endangered Species Act. They soon will, if the listing occurs. What we've been trying to do, those of us that are aware of these consequences and the damaging impact they could have on our communities, have been looking into the means that are available for reducing the chances of a listing. And those means are difficult to identify, but we've identified several. And that's with the help of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife folks and others, and here are four. First, there is the possibility that The area of critical habitat is about 10 million acres. Of the 10 million, about, 15 million acres. Of the 15 million acres, 10 is BLM, 5 is private, roughly. The BLM is taking steps under an amendment to its land use management plan to retool, if you will, the way that that 10 million acres of BLM land is used. And if that process will occur, and it's in the process of occurring, and there are a number of different options that they may select, but at the end of the day, the 10 million acres of BLM land will be used in a way that is more conducive to the survival of the species. The 5 million acres of private land, however, upon which much of this critical habitat is located, has to look to some other means of moving toward use that is conducive to the future of the bird. The device that the government has come up with is a CCAA, or a Candidate Conservation Agreement with Assurances. The CCAA is an agreement worked out over many years. I think it's taken 3 years now for Harney County to work toward such an agreement between a local soil and water conservation district on the one hand and U.S. Fish and Wildlife on the other. Hugely challenging to get one done, but when you do have it done, then landowners within that area of the CCAA can put together site plans, submit those site plans to the Soil Water Conservation District and U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And if those are approved, then the rancher or the landowner is issued a participation certificate, and they become sheltered under this CCAA umbrella. Now, I need to explain why would a private landowner enter into one of these things, because they're filled with rules and process and things that they're not currently required to follow. And the short answer is that if you enter into such an arrangement before the listing, then the restrictions that follow the listing don't apply to you. Instead, the CCAA governs what you do on your land. And so it gives those ranchers and other landowners the opportunity on this private land to enter into arrangements that will protect them from whatever may happen as a result of the listing. These are not simple matters. These CCAAs are complex and carefully negotiated. The idea, of course, is that when we're done with these arrangements, the bird will be protected. That's the idea. Well, here's the problem. When ranchers out in my area have been told about this, they've said, well, what do I have to disclose in my site-specific plan to the local soil and water conservation district, because I really don't want everybody knowing what and how and where and whatever I do on my land. It's nobody else's business. For example, the number of cattle, the water resources, the grazing patterns, fences or plans to build fences, roads or plans to build roads, photos of land improvements, coordinates of sites, and ecological assessments. All of those things are included in the site-specific plan. Again, this is a voluntary arrangement. People enter into it in order to avoid the consequences of the listing, so they don't have to do this. The point, though, is that if they do, we reduce the overall chance of the listing, which could be much more, I hate to say damaging, but that's what I'm going to say. One good example, by the way, and I kind of wish some of the utilities were here, is that we've been alerted to the fact that power lines already existent across my almost one-third of Oregon that pass through this critical 15 million acres, may at some point have to be buried. We can't do it. The idea is that if the birds are flying along, they might run into a power line and be killed. So thus, if you have to get a new license for your power line, you may not get it. You will have to build the power line around the critical 15 million acres of land, or do away with the power line or bury it. Okay, that's not going to happen. There's too big out there, too much space. And so if we don't have the listing and instead have these arrangements, we hopefully can avoid at least that part of a really negative future for Eastern Oregon. So that's what brings us here today with House Bill 4093. What it does is it adds an expansion, and I'll leave it up to Ms. McGee to elaborate on this, but an expansion to an already existing portion of our public records exemptions that apply to conservation agreements entered into between private landowners and the state. It should be understood that this is a state exemption. This would not protect necessarily the folks from the federal request under the FOIA. So it will provide some degree of protection because there's been some effort inside the CCAAs to provide some anonymity by using numbers for landowners instead of names and addresses. So there would be some modest help at the federal level. But our hope is that by providing this additional protection at the state level, we will be able to encourage more ranchers to at least consider this opportunity, and if we get enough land signed up, we may indeed avoid the listing. Apologize for the length of the explanation.
Any questions, Representative Tobey?
Thank you. I'm trying to understand this. It's all Greek to me. But I'm wondering why the landowners would not want anyone to know what they're doing to protect these birds. I would think that would be something they'd be proud of.
Right. Thank you for the question, Mr. Chair and Representative Tobey. The answer is I think they would be happy to share the fact that they're protecting the birds to avoid more egregious consequences. But there's much more information that can be used for other purposes, negative ones, that would be available in the event that someone asks. For people asking that have no interest in what the bird is doing at all. But here, let me share an idea. Mm-hmm. They may enter into the agreement, and someone may see what they're doing on the land and think that it cannot possibly be consistent with the Endangered Species Act or the agreement. And they then may want to go get the agreement and then file suit against the I think it's the Soil and Water Conservation District or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, trying to overturn the CCAA. And there are already protection mechanisms in place inside the process for making sure that landowners who enter into the agreements comply with them. There's a sequence of steps and reports and monitoring that has to be done to allow this process to continue. If people do not comply with the CCAA, they are removed and then instantly subject to the Endangered Species Act requirements. There's huge consequences if they fail to abide by the terms of the protective agreement that the CCA constitutes.
Help me understand how somebody could be harmed by any of this information that might go out, if I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative May, I guess it would depend on who has to pay to defend the lawsuit. That might be one level of concern if a lawsuit is initiated to challenge what a person is doing on their land. Another might be that perhaps you're doing something on your land, raising a certain type of crop, or doing something that gives you a competitive advantage over your neighbors. Or maybe you're doing something with water you don't want them to know about for whatever reason, and they want to figure that out. Or maybe you have a long-term plan to do something with your land that's totally consistent with the species, but not necessarily with what your neighbors have in mind. All of that is supposed to be disclosed in the agreement, but not necessarily should be the business of anybody that's around you.
So the federal agency could get that information if they were concerned, right? But you're saying the public, you're trying to protect the landowner from that information being open to all the public, right?
Right, Mr. Chair, Representative. To me, that's exactly right. The concept is that it's still going to be somewhat available at the federal level. If someone wanted to ask for that information, my understanding, if they can show a reason to get it, they can, and then they could use it as they will. I guess they'll see a number instead of the name of the owner. they wouldn't know exactly who owned it, but they would certainly, there would be the land. How they would trace back where it is unclear to me. I'm guessing they could get there. Here's the point. If the folks out there don't enter into these agreements, then these agreements place a enforcement mechanism over the landowner. These CCAAs do. One would wonder, it's going to take a huge amount of sales to get people to enter in these to begin with. They're not going to want to. What will happen is they'll say, let's just wait and for the listing. The listing's going to be worse. My challenge as the representative of these folks has been to convey to them what happened with our spotted owl communities and what happened down in the Klamath and what happened to fishing. We don't do those things anymore. And the point here is, if we can get people to enter into these agreements by removing such a small obstacle as this, we better remove it and try to get them into. It's for their protection, and frankly, it's for the state's protection. Because I can't say that we're the better for some of the things that have happened as a result of the spotted owl. I can't say it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Bentz, for coming to visit us. I have a question about the actual language of the bill, which sub 38 says reports voluntarily submitted to the State Department of Fish and Wildlife under 498-502. What else is included in voluntary reports submitted to the department? It seems very broad to me.
If I may, Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, my name is Maureen McGee. I'm from the Legislative Council's office. ORS 498-502 is a statute that was passed into law just last session, also having to do with the possibility of a listing for sage grouse that provides a mechanism for landowners, operators, people that are planning on doing a proposed action in an area that's been designated core area sage grouse habitat to submit a report to the State Department of Fish and Wildlife detailing what the proposed action is that they want to take, whether or not it will have an effect on sage grouse, and proposing their own mitigation efforts for those effects. There are some persons that may have in mind large projects that would be located in some very large scale, possibly energy projects, that sort of thing, that could be in these core area, sage grouse areas. And there are organizations that have the means to put together their own mitigation banks, for example, that they could have open, that they could open up to other organizations working with them. This provides a mechanism for those organizations to report on what their proposed mitigation bank might be, and start a dialogue with Fish and Wildlife to possibly use that route for sage grouse protection so they can move forward with their action.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bentz. I think I appreciate the spirit you're coming to. You're a leader in coming to us here with your leader in the community. You see the potential disaster for your community economically. You're trying to do everything you can to foreclose that. I respect that. However, the bill is following up on Representative Tomei's line of questioning. I'm not yet fully clear on the privacy interests we're really trying to protect here with this bill. Indeed, the example you used in response to Representative Tomei's question seems to me a good reason why we might not want to implement the bill, i.e. if someone were violating the CCAA. That seems like something that we would want to have reported to the regulatory agency. And this might potentially foreclose that, or at least make it more difficult. Help me get this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, good question. Let me see if I can explain it this way. So the key to not having a listing is somehow encouraging people to enter into mm-hmm. these agreements of how they're going to use their land.
Mm-hmm.
These agreements are not easily negotiated, and they're not simple to follow up on. They will be reviewed to make sure folks are doing what they're supposed to be doing under the plan. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's been a great deal of discussion about the nature of the monitoring that's going to occur. So there is a regulatory mechanism in place under the CCAA and under the Certificates of Participation. Hanging over those folks is the threat of being subjected to a more difficult future by virtue of the Endangered Species Act. Now, if our goal here is to encourage people to enter into these agreements and begin to use their land according to that, then we would do our very best to make sure that the enforcement mechanism you're thinking about, which is the private right of action, is not available here. Because what you're saying is we would like it if people would go out, catch people not doing what they should be doing, and sue them. And that's what's allowed under the Endangered Species Act, the private right of action. And so what we're trying to say here is, for goodness sakes, if you're looking for a regulatory mechanism that works, let's try one like this CCAA, which places something that many people out there are not going to... Getting people talked into this is very difficult. Very difficult. So I truly anticipate that most folks won't. Sad. And it would be doubly sad if we use this device, fail to modify, arrange, design this protection for what they disclose in a way that encourages them to enter into it. We need to do this. Now, I would ask what it is that we are giving up. If people want this information, they can use the federal tool to go get it. Mm-hmm. So the state protection, modest that it is still something I can point at and try to encourage people. So your concern is go ask the federal folk for the information. You're going to get it in a circular way. It will be a number instead of a name, as I understand it. Yeah, and someone's far more articulate and knowledgeable about this than I, sits to my right. So if she could answer it, I'm sure, better.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, I just wanted to respond as a legal matter to, I think the end of your question had to do with a concern that the language of this bill could somehow prevent information being released to the federal regulatory body, and that is, to the extent that may have been part of your question, that is not true. What this does is protect information that is going to be exchanged between the landowners and the Soil and Water Conservation District as part of that agreement at the state level.
Follow up. I want to try one more time. And I'm sorry to be dense. So, and this is the Judiciary Committee. We take public records law. We deal with it quite often. And as you can tell from this bill and the last, we take it pretty seriously. This is not a Natural Resources Committee. I personally have absolutely no idea whether people in your districts, I wouldn't presume to tell you whether they should go in CCAs or what. I defer that entirely. And I don't think that's what we're trying to decide here. What we're trying to decide is whether or not this exemption to the public records law should be enacted. And I suppose the interest I'm trying to get here is I just am not... I'm sorry. I'm going to stop. Perhaps we can take it offline. I'm sorry to be dense.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, I'm going to take a little shot. So if I enter into this agreement, there is oversight. But just my neighbor can't come in and say, what's he doing in the back 40? It's all right, but there's somebody, the state wildlife or the water district, they're monitoring to see that I do what I have agreed to do. And the records, somebody's looking at it. It's not like once you enter into that, your land is protected from anybody taking a look at it. But the Oregonian can't come out and say, I want to know what Cliff Benz is doing on his land, you know, 40 miles from here on the back third of his property or something. Right. On the 2 million hectares that we're talking about.
Far more than that.
Hectares.
10 million acres.
2 million hectares.
10.
Sorry.
Mr. Right? Too.
I'm sorry. A third of Oregon. How's that?
Yeah.
There's been, if I may, Mr. Chair, there's been some suggestion that the bill needs tightening up. I was actually asked by the governor's office to add this to a bill that included more elements than this. The other elements are now gone, and this is what remains. There have been others that have raised concerns. It may be that another amendment will be forthcoming to tighten down the scope of the protection afforded the information disclosed by people entering into these agreements. And I'm happy to continue the discussions offline.
Okay, and you have an amendment, is that correct?
I do.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. Representative Hicks.
My impression is, perhaps wrongly, but that this would be analogous to, for example, in the land use code, where property owners would have to get a soil sample, for example. You know, yeah. And we recently passed this bill, is 2011-2012, something like that. And so the results of the soil sample would need to be submitted to LCDC, and that we exempted, from my recollection, from public records release. The utility there is that the property owner will have an opportunity to go out and, if there's a problem, clean it up, and otherwise be able to take care of their own property, versus having to a judge order them to do so and go through all of the exertion and expense that would involve if it were releasable. And also, it would encourage a property owner to do the right conservationist-minded thing on their own property without having to think that everything they do is going to be scrutinized by someone who may seek to drag them into court. So that's an analogy that in my mind is playing out right now in terms of the utility of this bill. Does that make sense?
It does.
I think I grew up in Southern Oregon, and there are a lot of people who feel strongly about privacy of what people do on their land in the area where I grew up, and I could imagine that there are a lot of people in the district you represent who strongly want to safeguard the privacy of what they do on their land. And I think this matter and the matter we heard just before both bump up against a tough issue, which is, you know, we want, for public policy reasons, people to want to enter into CCAAs. Many people want, for public policy reasons, folks to want to ride transit. And I think there are a lot of people who are concerned that there's a chilling effect, perhaps, on landowners being willing to enter into CCAAs and potentially people being willing to ride transit if they feel that part of that bargain is they have to give up a lot of personal information that they'd like to continue to have private. And I think as we move forward and we try to honor the needs of, you know, publications to have access to information, we have to make sure that we're not inadvertently putting a chilling effect on other goals that we really want to have be achieved. So I appreciate very much what you're saying, and I think it's really important that we not erect barriers to people participating in a program like this.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Lindegren, for that. I do want to ask, I think you've captured what I was trying to say much better than I said it. I would ask Ms. McGee to reflect for just a moment on the fact that there already is a statute, already an exemption, that I think initially when we discussed this, she actually said you were already covered. So this concept is already in the exemptions. Am I right there? And there was a concept that was already
yes.
Providing protection to conservation agreements. And so when I first heard about this, we actually didn't think we were going to need it because we already had it. And then upon further reflection, it appeared that we needed to expand that which we now have. Am I right there?
Yes. Yes, you are correct. So there's already an exemption that exists in ORS 192501, subsection 33, for land management plans required for voluntary stewardship agreements entered into under ORS 541423. I don't have the text of 541423 in front of me right now, but if memory serves, that is a statute that allows for a very similar process of folks entering into stewardship agreements, I believe, with the Department of Forestry. That are subject to many of the same types of reporting and data collection mechanisms that someone who enters into an agreement with the Soil and Water Conservation Districts would be subject to. So it's a very similar process because they're entering into agreements with different folks under 541-423. It's with a state agency, and under this proposed new section, it would be an agreement with Soil and Water Conservation. We have to have different subsections in the law, but there is a very similar mechanism in place. And I would just add that 541-423 specifically provides, again, if memory serves, that those stewardship agreements can be used as part of a CCAA with the federal government. So it's a very, very similar mechanism that we're providing protection. I would also just add quickly that Representative Hicks, your analogy, I believe, is very apt. These agreements that the landowner will enter into with the Soil and Water Conservation District allow the Soil and Water Conservation District, as I understand it, to come out and do a lot of regular data gathering that would likely result in a large amount of data all about what's being done on the land and how it's being managed to ensure enforcement of the for enforcement and to ensure compliance with the CCAA. So okay. I believe that that's an apt analogy.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Bottomley, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Therese Bottomley from the Oregonian. For the record, I don't believe I've ever seen a sage-grouse in the wild, but I am here because I care about the public records law. So I guess I would be brief, since I don't know a lot about this bill, but I would wonder a couple things. Why on earth would we want Oregon's public records law to be more restrictive and less transparent than the Federal Freedom of Information Act? I think I heard that a lot of this information could be gotten through FOIA. So, again, that's just a question. Why would we want to be more restrictive when the federal government is giving out much of this information? Second, it seems to me that the owners of 5 million acres of private land are getting a benefit here. The benefit is of avoiding the consequences if the grouse is listed. In exchange for that benefit, I would think there should be some public accountability piece to it. You know, third, it might be the farmer, you know, Farmer Joe, who doesn't want people to know how many cattle he has, but it might be a wind turbine outfit who wants to put up a bunch of wind turbines. You know, it's not all individual farmers. It could be big energy companies as well. And last, I think there was some conversation about competitive advantage, and I would just point you once again to the existing law, 192.501.2, conditionally exempts trade secrets, and it defines that as information which is used in a business and which gives a user an opportunity to obtain a business advantage over competitors who do not know it or use it. So again, I think the existing law has provisions which can take accomplish what this might accomplish.
And from what I understood, the testimony prior to you, the federal information would be anonymous. I mean, so you'd say Farm 101, somebody could maybe figure out who that was.
But you could still get all the other information. So this would still make Oregon public records law more restrictive.
And the other thing, it is better for, I think, not being a city kid, I don't know much about Eastern Oregon either, but well, it's beneficial if things aren't listed. It's beneficial not only to the farmer but to all of us if we can keep a species off the endangered species list. So I don't put all that on the farmer. I think we all benefit from that if something's not listed there.
Chair Barker, I would agree with that, but I would say, as it was compared to the spotted owl, that the effect of listing makes it even more important for accountability and transparency about the ways we're trying to prevent the listing.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
Thank you. This actually is not a question. May I just make?
Yeah, sure.
Just an observation. I felt like I really didn't get my questions answered that in a way that I could understand. And I had been on the Water Committee for some years, and I think, Representative Krieger, you might have been also. And we would visit places where the conservation districts were. And so when I asked that question, why wouldn't they be proud of what they were doing to protect their property and the grouse? I'm still unclear on why.
I think they would be proud, and they'd say, I'm part of that program. But you can't come in, you from Milwaukee, you can't come out to my place in east of Burns and come out and look around and tell me what to do. I mean, it's that's the kind of thing, because you would be able to, if it's not protected, you'd be able to go out there and ask these questions. They're worried about the lawsuits that we've seen all over, you know, like the spot owl thing. But I don't think the people object to being noticed that they're in the program. They just want the privacy of their property kept out of public view for whatever reason. I mean, it just might, there's a lot of people just would like some privacy, and as we're seeing how much less of it we have everywhere. That's my kind of. Any further questions? Thank you very much. This bill is ready to go today.
I would be pleased to talk with Representative Bentz further. However, if you want to move it today, I will be a polite no, and then maybe I'll change my vote on the floor once I talk with Representative Bentz. It's up to you. I don't mean to delay the whole committee.
I'm in the same case.
And so am I.
Okay. We'll just have a closed public hearing today, and if
thank
you need to talk offline, you see if you can do something. Okay. Next item on the agenda is House Bill 4094, and I'm pleased to see that Representative Torrey, who's spending a whole lot of our afternoon sitting in here, is ready to come up. A summary, please.
Certainly. Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 4094 is sponsored by Representative Doherty. It creates an exemption to the minor in possession statutes when a person is seeking medical assistance for themselves or another for alcohol poisoning, and the only evidence of minor being in possession is the act of seeking medical assistance.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Margaret Doherty. I'm the House Representative for House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. I come before you today with a good bill designed to save lives. It extends a limited legal immunity to those minors who summon medical aid for another minor who is suffering alcohol poisoning, and for those minors who are suffering alcohol poisoning and seek treatment. Probably the worst thing a parent can face is that knock on the door at 3:00 in the morning and having a police officer on the front door. And unfortunately, underage drinking is quite common in Oregon, and even more unfortunate, these minors will sometimes drink themselves to alcohol poisoning. We had a case just this fall at the University of Oregon where they had 5 students in one day end up in the hospital for alcohol poisoning. But far more frightening are those minors who end up in the hospital than those minors who end up in the hospital are those that don't. Alcohol poisoning is an incredibly serious situation that requires immediate medical attention, and the specter of the young person abandoned on a couch or on a front step with no aid is hauntingly familiar. As the studies in front of you show, and these were the studies that were sent to you earlier transmitted by email, this situation is a result of the fear of calling for help because of the possibility of involving law enforcement. When the fear is removed, calls for minors who need medical assistance go up dramatically. A Cornell University study found that implementing a program like this increased calls to the emergency services by 45%. This is happening as levels of underage drinking either stay the same or fall, according to statistics on the National Abuse and Mental Health Administration, the branch of the Health and Human Services that tracks statistics on underage drinking. The fact is that these young people are making a lot of bad decisions. They're choosing to drink underage, and they're choosing to drink at a very unhealthy level. These choices are awful, but they shouldn't merit a death sentence, which is what the fear of an MIP sometimes can become. The bill in front of you will save lives by encouraging young people to call emergency services. We can make sure that no one's bad decision is a terminal decision. This bill is very narrowly written. It applies only to the MIP charge, which is a Class B violation, which is on the same level as a speeding ticket. It does not apply or in any way affect the more serious charges that might be associated with drinking, such as a DUII or providing alcohol to minors. The bill contains a provision that specifies that if evidence in another crime, such as drug use or driving under the influence, is discovered, it is unaffected by this bill. It may be tempting to tamper with the bill and replace it with a diversion or affirmative defense clause, but we should remember that so long as calling 911 will lead to an MIP, kids will not pick up the phone. The alternative to this bill isn't minors getting MIPs, but it's them not calling for help at all. The bill further specifies that the immunity only applies if the evidence of the underage drinking is found as a result of seeking medical assistance, as a result of seeking medical help for oneself or another person. So in order to be covered by this bill, the minor would need to actively seek medical attention. This is a common sense idea that's been passed in 17 other states and is in 10 other legislations as we speak, and also the District of Columbia. These states are as diverse as Utah and California. It simply makes sense to prioritize the health of minors in a life or death situation. I hope you pass this bill. I'm open for questions.
Any questions for Mr. Olson?
Thank you. So, Margaret, you and I had some conversation about education component to this. Can you, and I never did ask you this question when we had this conversation about what are the other states doing along that line?
You know, to be honest with you, I don't know what the other states are doing for the education. I can get you that information. I think in relation to the education component, although it's not written into the bill, it is one that a lot of universities and colleges are already doing. I give kudos to the state colleges and some of the private universities that are going through, and whether it's freshman week, whether it's the hiring, they've got full-time substance abuse counselors. They work with local law enforcement that kids that looks like they're having problem off campus, they will be referred to the abuse counselors on campus to get help. Oregon State University is opening up a sober dorm in the fall of 2014, which I think is another great ability. On the high school level, I think there's more and more emphasis on the educating of kids in drinking. I just look at my own community. We have a program called Tiger Turns the Tide, which we work with mental health in Washington County, the high school district, and law enforcement. And it's a real program not to have kids do it. They have something called the Stud Club, which is Stop Teenage Underage Drinking and Driving. And drugs, and the best thing about it, it's the cool kids at Tiger High School that are in this program, and it has cut back teenage drinking and drugs significantly in the city of Tiger. And so an education component is something we can work with. It's not in this bill, though.
Thank you.
We encourage the policies to continue at the university level.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Representative.
Okay, thank you. One thing I want to mention, we had a couple of people that were witnesses that had to go, but okay. You have all of the testimony in your packets.
Okay, yes. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Greg Mills and Katie King.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Barton and Krager, and members of the committee. My name is Greg Mills, and I'm the student body vice president at the University of Oregon. I'm a senior accounting major in the business school, and I have also been a member of Delta Tau Delta fraternity at the U of O for the past 4 years. When it comes to alcohol on campuses, I consider myself to have been a firsthand witness to about every situation the typical college student encounters, including instances of alcohol poisoning and addiction. This bill is a step in the right direction to ensure that students do the right thing for their peers while addressing a dangerous situation caused by alcohol, and I fully support its passage. Earlier this academic year, over the course of a single weekend, 5 University of Oregon women were hospitalized with alcohol-related issues. Luckily, correct measures were taken to prevent serious consequences stemming from a weekend meant to celebrate the return of the student body to campus for the fall quarter. Fraternity and Sorority Life at the University of Oregon mandates that students receive alcohol education training when they pledge, as well as sober monitors at every fraternity and sorority function. While these measures can help save a life for the students involved in fraternity and sorority life, what happens if these measures fail? And what happens about the 88% of students outside of fraternity and sorority life who receive no such training or have no designated sober monitors at their parties who can respond in an event requiring medical attention? We all have heard the statistic in the media. Each year, 1,700 college students die from alcohol-related accidents, and over 100,000 are arrested for alcohol-related violations. In Eugene alone, at the close of the 2012 calendar year, there were 1,908 liquor violations and 2,813 liquor-related arrests. 544 of these violations were for minor in possession charges. Not all of these violations were necessarily U of O college students. However, binge drinking at the Oregon universities is a systemic issue. In the 2008 to 2010 biennial report on alcohol and drugs released by the University of Oregon, I could not find the 2010-2012 report, 44% of U of O students identified themselves as binge drinkers, a statistic that has not changed for 15 straight years at the time of that report. 21%, or 4,600 students, said that they had been physically injured as a result of their drinking, and 34%, over 7,000 students, had said that they had forgotten where they were or what they were doing as a result of their drinking. In colloquial college student terms, this is the stage that we call blacking out, which is an identifier that one is experiencing alcohol poisoning. For these 7,000 students, the idea of needing medical assistance may become a reality. While such a scenario can seem plain as day to those of us seated in this room, the decision capabilities of a young undergraduate under the influence of alcohol and social pressure are generally compromised. Rarely is someone able to drive an unconscious friend to a hospital due to being under the influence themselves, which means calling 911 and bringing assistance to a party filled with minors in possession and individuals under the influence of alcohol. Even if a student is able to combat social pressures and make the correct decision to call for help, they may be putting themselves, their friends, and the injured or unconscious individual in legal jeopardy. For young college students establishing themselves as adults, the prospect of facing legal trouble is daunting. Legal penalties start with a minor in possession charge at $250, allowing consumption by minors goes up to $1,000, and having an open container in public can even lead to an arrest. Some of these charges can also turn into academic consequences. If an international student receives a serious charge or multiple misdemeanors, such as MIPs, on their record, they risk being deported. Other students, already burdened with the heavy financial cost of school, risk incurring financial penalties they cannot bear while also being enrolled in classes. I don't think any of these reasons should prevent someone from taking action that could possibly save a life, and this bill would help alleviate the fear of legal and financial repercussions. I have no doubt that this bill could possibly save lives. That in the mind of an intoxicated college student, legal amnesty could be the tipping variable in a very difficult situation where a friend relying on them to make the correct decision. I encourage you to help Oregon join the 17 states that have already passed this law and give young people the ability they need to act responsibly in the presence of alcohol by passing House Bill 4094. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Great. Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Katie King, and I'm here today representing OSEP, the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. OSEP supports House Bill 4094, and ER physicians are frequently called upon to provide care for people of all ages who experience alcohol overdose. Alcohol poisoning is a medical emergency that results from high blood alcohol levels that suppress the central nervous system and can cause loss of consciousness, low blood pressure and body temperature, coma, respiratory depression, or death. The Centers for Disease Control report that over 1.2 million emergency room visits and 2.7 million physician office visits due to excessive alcohol use in 2006. You've heard about tragedies that result from teenage binge drinking, but let me share some stories with you from OSEP physicians about young people doing the right thing. Recently, a student brought a friend into an emergency room in Eugene. The young patient had extremely high blood alcohol levels, and immediate measures needed to be taken to support the patient's breathing. However, the choice of the student to bring the friend in may have saved his life. The emergency room physician made a point of thanking the student for having the courage to bring his friend in for help rather than wait until it was too late. The other colleagues in the emergency room followed suit. Another example, a 15-year-old female was dropped off in an Oregon emergency department late at night, not breathing, unresponsive, and smelling of alcohol. Her friends gave her name and left. The emergency department physician had to intubate her and put her on a respirator to breathe for her until the next morning. Fortunately, she had no obvious residual damage and was discharged home with her family. So the kids did the right thing by bringing her in, but it just as easily could have been too late. And finally, an 18-year-old male college freshman was found by another student at a school event on the restroom floor. He was unresponsive but breathing on his own, but possibly he had aspirated vomit. He was naive about alcohol but urged to drink more and more by an upperclassman. Sometime between the patient being transferred to the hospital by ambulance, the police served him with an MIP ticket. He did not realize that since he was unconscious when it was served. The patient recovered overnight on oxygen and observation in the emergency department of the local hospital. The patient later found the ticket in a pair of jeans a few weeks after the incident. He didn't remember anything concerning it and, in fact, didn't know what an MIP was. All of these patients were very fortunate not to have died of respiratory arrest from acute alcohol poisoning. In these instances, the window between life and death is short, and it's critical to get the patient to immediate medical help. Rather than serve an unconscious person an MIP, it's more helpful to tell the friends that brought the patient in that they did the right thing and to educate them on the dangers of alcohol poisoning. This bill will help promote more scenarios like that. In summary, this is good policy to help young people make better decisions during an emergency. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. King? Okay, thank you, Pat. David, I can't read that. Amesbury? Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is David Amesbury. I'm a deputy district attorney in Benton County, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I registered as an opponent to this bill, and I actually have two different things I'd like to address in my testimony. The first part is the concept of the bill. And this is really a choice that the legislature has to make. And my purpose here in pointing out the issue that we observe is for you to weigh those in deciding how to deal with this bill. And those are born of the experience of the number of prosecutors who are on our committee. I personally have been a prosecutor for 7 years, a juvenile prosecutor for about 3.5 of those. A number of other members of our committee have been prosecutors for much longer. And our sense in discussing the bill was that it will lead to the problems that are outlined in the first three paragraphs of my testimony. That is, that it will remove the power of the courts and the juvenile departments to address the root cause of this intoxication, where you have a juvenile who is brought in, say dropped off at an emergency room, he's intoxicated, he's treated. Under existing law, then the juvenile department or the courts could become involved and require the juvenile, if he's under 18, to submit to treatment, to submit to an education program and get to the root of the problem. Because, frankly, in my experience, and I think it's a common experience, we don't have a lot of one-time drinkers who get intoxicated to the point where they're almost going to die and then they go to the emergency room. And it's also my experience, we don't catch most juvenile drinkers. So when we see juveniles come in who are intoxicated to that level, generally it's a chronic problem for them, and there's something more deep-seated than one time they decided to binge drink. The current situation allows the court or the juvenile department, in the case of juveniles under 18 or minors under 18, to essentially require treatment and education, and in the case of those between 18 and 20, to encourage it by offering, at least in Benton County and a number of other counties, a diversion program where they would not receive a conviction so long as they go through the steps of a education and treatment program. So that's as it exists now, and paragraphs 1 through 3 really are the expectations based on our experience of what might result. But it could just as easily happen differently from this. Perhaps it will result in a good effect. Our evaluation is it probably will result in more intoxicated juveniles that we can't even force into treatment. We'll just keep seeing them. The other opposition, and I think this I've discussed this with Representative Doherty, if the legislation is going to be adopted by this committee and by the legislature, we perceive some mechanical problems with the bill as drafted. It uses the term alcohol poisoning a number of times. It doesn't define that term, and that term actually can have different meanings depending on the context. It might make sense to actually broaden that if the committee, if the legislature is going to pass that, to include perhaps it might not be alcohol poisoning, it might be some other illness combined with alcohol intoxication, or maybe just use a term something as severe alcohol intoxication. But it shouldn't be restricted to that. Some of the other things that are that we foresee as problems, the way it's set up, it's unclear legally how this comes before a court. If it comes before a court as a defense, does the state is it an affirmative defense? Is it an ordinary defense? And that's something that it would make it easier for us as prosecutors in executing whatever law the legislature passes if we understood. Do we have to come in and prove somebody didn't have a belief, or does somebody have to come in and show, no, I actually believe this, and then we have to address that? And that's kind of a mechanical aspect. I did review some of the statutes in other states. I did not look at all 18. I believe I reviewed in some detail the statutes in six other states, and there are a number of differences from the proposed bill here, and I wish to provide these to the committee. There's something I would like to discuss with Representative Doherty afterwards, but something that the committee should consider. For instance, in Texas, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, and North Dakota, a person making this report, and this is kind of the Good Samaritan aspect, where you have a friend who is intoxicated, but you as a juvenile also are intoxicated, and you want to summon help for them. If you do that, you get the defense, but you have to remain at the scene. You have to provide identification. You have to cooperate with law enforcement. You can't just make one call and run off and receive the immunity. Different states have placed a limit on the number of people who can use the defense in connection with a single event. So, for instance, under the proposed legislation in 4094, if you had 70 people at a party and the cop came to the door and they all yelled out, hey, our friend in the bathtub, they might all get the immunity, or maybe some of them would and some of them wouldn't. In Texas, only the first person to make notification gets the immunity. In North Dakota, a maximum of five, and the statute doesn't explain how you would determine which five. In Minnesota, the immunity is for the person making the report and up to two additional people who help out. So if you have friends that get together. In Pennsylvania, only the person actually making the report. Some of the other limitations, and I would... our committee would throw out to this committee that those are ideas that the committee should consider. How do you want to circumscribe it? Do you want to make it as many people as possible get the immunity? That is a choice that this committee is faced with. Some of the other limitations, and this seemed like a good one, in Pennsylvania, you can only get the immunity if you call 911 or if you notify some kind of emergency care provider or law enforcement. In Minnesota, only if you call 911. In North Dakota, it's a little broader, any emergency medical service care provider or law enforcement. Under the bill as drafted, it needs to be the language is that they sought medical assistance, but it doesn't say who they could seek that from, the next door neighbor, a friend of theirs. That's the kind of thing that I think if the committee is inclined to pass it, we would like the opportunity to work with Representative Doherty to maybe address some of those issues that perhaps she didn't consider in deciding how this should go out as law. Chair Barker?
Any questions?
If any members of the committee have questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
I know the idea behind this is we don't want some kid dying. And from my experience, I'm a retired primarily Portland cop, so I didn't have much to deal with college, on the campus kind of things. But the people in their apartments, even those who are not in college, you'd see these people, really drunk. And we don't want somebody dying because the kid's afraid to call in. But I will not move the bill today. I will ask you to meet with Representative Doherty so we can clarify some of these points, because none of us on this committee want a bill that is too broadly written so that it doesn't work. I mean, we want to save those. We're interested in saving those kids. Class B violation doesn't seem like, I mean, you know, being the old cop, I don't care if somebody gets an arrest or not for that. And but if we could, but you made some, I think, some valid points about if the law doesn't say it, it isn't in there, and so we need to have those points clarified. If you would work with Representative Doherty, but we need a very fast turnaround.
If
we can't get that done,
Chair
we
Barker.
May pass it out as is and try to fix it on the other side of the building. Well, it's this side of the building now. We used to be on the other side of the building, but on the Senate, have the Senate repair it if you can't get it done very quickly.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 4094, and any further business come before the committee today. We are adjourned. Thank you, committee.